Hey friends, welcome to the final episode of the season, Power Shifts. This has been an incredible delight and really insightful in my own life. And I'm still actually, I'm re-listening to episodes to tell you the truth personally, just to remind myself and to reinvigorate myself in all of these shifts that are happening and how I can participate in them well. Oh, wow. This one is so good because it's four friends from around the world who work with World Vision, many of them for many, many years, a lifetime of work in development and trying to make the world better in some of the most fragile and hard contexts. We have Europe, we have Romania represented here, we have Albania experience there, we have Zimbabwe, we have South Africa, we have Lebanon in the Middle East, and we have Canada. We're traveling the globe through these voices and their experiences. So pay attention to some of this stuff. The shift in development in terms of what's happening in the world and how people are engaging in it has so much to teach us, first about engagement, but also about some of the shifts happening in our own world as well. So I'm learning. You're going to hear from Dana and Maya and Matt and McLean. And it is, they have way more. We talked for many more hours than you're going to hear. And we condense this conversation into the nuggets that we think are most important for this moment in time. And so a big shout out and thank you to World Vision for offering these incredible experts and to these beautiful people who are at work around the world. And I'm believing and praying that this conversation will help inspire and enlighten and motivate you to enter into this beautiful work of making the world a better place together.
So my name is Maya Assaf-Horstmeyer, and I'm the Fragile Context Programming and Peacebuilding Director for World Vision. My passion is peacebuilding. and I guess this comes from the fact that I come from a conflict context. I was born and grew up in Lebanon. And during the 80s, I was a war child. And I guess growing up in that context made me want to do something and made me want to contribute to a change. And I felt that God's calling for me was to do peace building, which I wanted to do. I joined an NGO first. I joined World Vision doing something completely different, but I ended up doing peace building. I'm really thankful to God for that journey, because ultimately I really did what I always dreamt of doing as a child.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that you dreamt of that as a kid. And just like you were, how old would you have been? And you just would have been like, things don't have to be like this. Is it just a general, like, we could do things differently?
Yeah. I remember when we would have to kind of run or kind of leave school with my dad under the bombs. And we didn't know what was going to happen at this point. Were we going to make it home or not? Like, there was this constant feeling of, please, God, bring us home safely. And then kind of having to think, why should we have to live like this? Something's not right. Children are not supposed to live in fear like this, you know? And I also remember as a kid that UNICEF had done quite a few peace building initiatives where they were trying to bring children from different communities together through like booklets, through activities and stuff. And I remember exactly what the characters were about, and I was absolutely amazed by what they came up with. And it was so funny, but when I joined World Vision, I read a case study about that same project. Wow. So many years later, and I remembered that it was SAWA. It was called SAWA, it means together. And I remember these books and I remembered that project and I was just amazed.
That's so powerful. And also, like, look at you now. They obviously worked, right? They obviously worked in terms of painting the possibilities of a different future and like embedding that stuff in you as a child. And now you're living this beautiful child dream. Wow. It's gorgeous. Thanks for sharing that. Matt, do you want to catch us up on who you are, what you're doing? And
sure. I'm Matt and I raise money for those fragile contexts and the peace building work that we do. I have ended up in a very similar place to Maya, but by a totally different journey. Maya and I worked together closely for years and we work together today still, but we were in the same team for many years. I came up in a very privileged upbringing. I'm a self-described Diplo brat. my father was a career diplomat with the Canadian Foreign Service. We lived around the world, but my existence was very sheltered and very privileged. And I was schooled in the ways of peace building after joining World Vision by young peace builders. In fact, my first encounter with the peace building work of World Vision was through a young woman. At the time, she was 15, Mayerly Sanchez from Colombia, who at the time had started a children's peace movement when she was, just amazingly young. And I was seeing pictures of the sustainable movement she was creating in Colombia. And I thought, I need to figure out how we learn from young women like that and how we help accelerate and amplify their efforts. Came via a very different privileged route to the same calling of God to work for peace in the world and to amplify the efforts of peace builders so that they echo through these contexts of fragility and violence and conflict.
That's great. I mean, and I think that's a beautiful, like beautiful partnership, right? That we all have places and things that we can offer and do and think critically through. And I love that posture, Matt, of just saying like, this is already happening. People already are living their dreams and doing beautiful work in the world. And a large part of what privilege is leveraging it for others. That's what it's for. So I love how you're modeling that. Can you guys walk me through, like, there has been some massive shifts in the way that development is done. World Vision has been at it for 75 years or something more than that. And so some major shifts have happened in terms of how development happens on the ground, how it works. You guys particularly have at the center of all your work, the most vulnerable children. So I think that's a particular thing we just want to mention right up. This is the kind of development that centers around a vulnerable child. What have been the major shifts? Like, if you could say like, whoa, I see this, I see that, you know, like what have been the major shifts when it comes to how you do your work? Maybe Maya, you want to kick us off?
Sure.
There have been a number of shifts, I would say over the past couple of decades. We see many more extreme weather hazards, caused by climate change, and that continue to uproot people in the world and cause displacement and refugees. We have many more health threats posed by global pandemics like COVID-19, for example, that have also devastated economies. We have many more civil wars happening in countries, and we have, rising costs and persistent instability and recurring disasters in many countries across the world that have led to unprecedented levels of food insecurity. Unfortunately. And I would say also that children have been really impacted by all these factors. Today, we watch a million of children suffering from wasting, millions denied of education, and worst of all, millions of children who are on the move. so who are displaced, who are refugees and who have nowhere to go and are living somewhere temporarily with their parents. And I think far too many encounter danger, detention, deprivation, and also discrimination on those journeys. Matt, like, it would be great to hear your perspectives as well.
Yeah, you put it beautifully, Maya. The perfect storm, unfortunately, of conflict, climate change, and COVID have combined to put unprecedented levels of children and their families on the move. We keep setting records every year for the last decade on the number of people who are not at home. They're just on the run. And the kind of vulnerability, the kind of mental anguish that creates is going to echo through generations. That we can't undo that. That's in motion. That means that we have to rethink as an organization and as a community of organizations that provide aid, to rethink the way that we do that aid. In the past, we kind of had those emergency help things that we did, short-term interventions, and we did them over in kind of one corner of our organization. And then we had all of the long-term poverty stuff that we do, that you know, World Vision for child sponsorship, for example. But unfortunately, those two things weren't making the best of those two skill sets. And the moment that you just heard Maya describe, the confluence of these trends, all of them worsening, require us to combine the best of those two worlds. So we need to have this agile, light approach to responding to people in urgent need, very serious vulnerability, and also keep our eyes fixed on a long-term target of lifting people out of that vulnerability, of stopping that cycle of continued vulnerability, of providing ways that children, families, and communities can be more resilient so they can bend, not break when these threats come. So that's something we're really wrestling with as an organization, how to make the best of that expertise of different funding streams, of different approaches. It requires, in some ways, paradoxical skills of being really in the moment and also having a long-term view. And I would say one more thing is just the amount of data now that we have. We're drowning in data, and we need to be much better at making sense of it all. Mm-hmm. It used to be we sort of, I think the peace building movement, the peace world, could be characterized as a bit kumbaya and a little bit like, oh, we'll just, you know, talk it out. And those skills are all great and really important. But we also now have a lot of data that we need to know how to use, know how to leverage. And so if we know that the conflict is heading in a particular direction, and we know there are interventions that work in those types of situations, we need to pivot to that instead of relying on one solution, one approach that we may have used in another context. We've got enough of a toolbox now that we need to know when to use the screwdriver, when to use the hammer, when to use the saw, instead of kind of a hammer approach always and ever.
So in sort of development shifting, there's the you know, the things that Maya, that you mentioned, that are like the climate change, these new things, like there's never been more displaced people on the earth than this moment. So this people on the move and kids, the reality of that. Can you walk me through, Maya, just sort of some of the things that you're doing differently? So if you came on World Vision 75 years ago, you probably would have been raising money for an orphanage. You probably would have been raising money for like a food aid program. What are you doing differently now? How has your even approach to development in fragile context changed?
Because of all these things constantly changing and happening in context, we really need to change the way that we used to work previously. Mm-hmm. So let's say before, the way we used to think and the way that most large multi-mandated organizations like World Vision, who do humanitarian and development work, used to think a little bit more in a linear fashion. So let's say we had a big crisis, we would go and respond to the needs of people in the crisis. After that, we would assume that there's a recovery period. So we would do some recovery activities. And after that, we would go back to development. And we all know that the reality in a fragile context is completely different. We know that we might have in a certain context elections that might fail, and that can change the context completely. We may have price drops all of a sudden. We may have, we might have a cholera outbreak. We may have a terrorist attack somewhere. So we have constant shocks that are constantly affecting those contexts where we work. And if we think in that linear fashion, we will obviously become obsolete because we're sort of trying to respond to something against the current, like we're not responding to the actual needs on the ground. So I guess the shift, or what is different in the fragile context program approach, is that the context plays a huge role in all that. So context analysis, let's say, for that, understanding the context, understanding what is most likely to happen in that context, is really important because it will allow people who are, implementing a certain program to keep monitoring the context and seeing how it shifts. So for example, this continuous context monitoring may show us that the situation is getting worse. So we know now that we need to get ready to do an emergency response. But we may also have instances where we monitor the context and it shows a positive trend. It shows us that the situation is getting better. And we therefore know that we can also shift our programming to fit that new reality. Mm-hmm. So this flexible way of doing things has been very helpful. And to go back to the dial conversation, the programming approach has three dials: mm-hmm. survive, adapt, and thrive. So very much like what we have been talking about, the survive dial is basically tuned up whenever the context shows that there's a need to shift to emergency response. The adapt dial is tuned up whenever there's, we have the indicators show that the context is improving. And we know that although it's probably really hard to reach a thrive dial in a fragile context, but we know then we might need to also further think about our programming and perhaps kind of start looking at tackling root causes of that conflict or changing the types of work that we do to strengthening systems and doing things that we can't usually do when there's an emergency. So this is just to say that this flexible approach allows us to work in these fluid contexts according to the need. And I think one other good thing about this approach is that it enables us to respond to the current needs. So if we have more of an emergency situation, we can still respond to the communities in needs. And at the same time, we can address the longer term needs by dealing with the root causes of the conflict, by understanding the root causes of the conflict and making sure that we have these programming options in place for when the situation changes. So I'm going to stop here.
Yeah, no, that was so cool. Those three dials, I think, are just so helpful. And some of the things that you've just said, Maya, I think it's so fascinating when we're talking about power shifts in general. So we're talking about development with vulnerable kids at the center, but we could literally be having a conversation with a room full of pastors who are experiencing the exact same shift. Like the conditions are not normal. Like they're shifting right when we think they're okay. They're not okay. There's all this people are in different places, but at the same time, this thriving, what we're aiming for, all of us together, is thriving. We're not just aiming for survival, we're aiming for thrive. I love that idea that like, this is actually where we're all headed. We believe, and this is maybe part of the influence of the faith journey of World Vision, but we believe that God has in mind, Jesus's whole mandate was to bring life in all of its fullness. So this is not enough for us just to kind of survive. But when you're in the moment of like, I've got to eat or I'm going to die, then we respond. But even some of those words that you use, like adaptability and flexibility and nonlinear thinking, you know, just all of those things seem to me to be like the shift in how people lead, how agencies work. And you can see, like, even when you have all the resources in the world, you know, in a Western context, and you're just like flush with cash, you still can't even make this happen. Because this isn't just a cash problem. This is like a mindset problem. This is a posture issue. This is like, what's at your center? Like, what's your long-term goal? Why are you even in this work? So I think you just talked about, we could talk about all of those things, but I love that idea of this dial, almost like a development DJ in a way, where you're like able to flex and flow and then go back to dial one, turn this up, turn this down. And I can see just even how that would be so powerful, that flexibility to do that. Tell me about how your faith and the Christian belief at the heart of World Vision, you know, that kind of launched this movement into being, how does that actually affect the way you do development?
Our approach to peace building inherits the same theological foundation, Danielle, that you teach in courses, the understanding that peace is not simply the absence of conflict, mm-hmm. but the presence of shalom, this much more full-bodied theological idea embedded from Hebrew scriptures to today of God's fullness of life mm-hmm. coming abundantly, the kingdom of God coming. That includes, yes, the absence of conflict, but also the absence of want, the absence of violence against children, the absence of illness, the absence of poverty. So our approach to peace building is informed by that same biblical vision that you do an amazing job of teaching. I've taken your course. We've used it for devotional materials. That is that concept, the very specifically Christian idea that at the resurrection, Jesus began a new kingdom that is breaking into this world, a world that when we look out today seems dark and filled with violence and conflict, yet that kingdom is breaking in. We get glimpses of it in that peace-building work. Christians and Muslims sit down together, share their scriptures, mutually committing them to peace. We say, we do this because of Jesus. Muslims say, we do this because the Prophet Muhammad told us to do this. That is where we fully believe we're living into Jesus' call to build peace. Mm-hmm. And the startling thing about that is you would think in contexts where faith is the contesting issue, mm-hmm. that a strong expression of our Krishna identity would actually irritate things. It's actually the opposite. Mm-hmm. The more explicit and clear we can be about our Christian identity, and yes, decouple it from all kinds of other agendas and colonialism and imperialism and other things, but to strip it down to our commitment to Jesus clears the air, builds bridges, doesn't put up walls. Mm-hmm. And that's a principle that we continue to practice. In fact, we've developed resources for use with mixed Christian Muslim communities to help Christians really re-understand and re-own the mandate of peace that is given to us in scripture, mm-hmm. and to help Muslims also discover in their own sacred texts that same call, and to say we may be motivated for different reasons in different texts, but it still pushes us towards the direction of peace. That is the much more sustainable approach, rather than sort of hiding in our holy huddle or saying, you know, this Jesus thing is not, we're not comfortable sharing it in different contexts. There are, however, places where we have to be very sensitive and take great care to explain it, especially when violence is very near and very sharp. It takes a very, very careful approach. But in the vast majority of Muslim contexts where World Vision works, it is our preferred policy to be open, clear about our Christian identity, the reason for why we do what we do. And that's a much more sustainable approach. The do no harm principle is also embedded in it. Mm-hmm. The do no harm principle is not just a good idea, but it's also an explicit approach. It's defined in our peace building world. It's written down. There's a book by that name. Mm-hmm. And the principle in Do No Harm that we take seriously in all our work, and Maya oversees that, is of listening first. This is a Christian idea, right? We want to not impose our will on others. We don't want to, we want to listen to our neighbor, not come with an agenda. And that's where peace building begins. Not coming with a program, not even with our three dials. You know, it's a great idea, but mm-hmm. I've often had conversations with donors who are action oriented, and they say, "Oh, what's the one thing World Vision needs to do in this context, or what are the five things World Vision needs to do in this context?" And I always try to say, "Well, it's just one thing. Just listen." When we're in a context, we listen. And the wonderful thing that I'm always encouraged by when I travel to our projects is that well north of 95% of our staff are from the context where they work. So I'm the outsider, and I'm accompanying staff who are from that context. They're embedded in that context. They're way better at listening than I'm ever going to be. But following their lead in that listening posture is how we actually get to, you know, do effective work. That listening can't be emphasized enough.
Yeah, that's a major shift just there, just like to go in and listen to people for what it is that they need, what it is they even want. You know, I think there's so much sort of development history. And then, like you said, that decoupling our faith in Jesus, our desire to follow Jesus from all the agenda and the colonial history of what that Christendom, kind of building Christendom instead of the kingdom, that is tricky business here, particularly, but I would imagine it's even more tricky where you are. But that's, you know, what's really interesting to me, Matt, even as you say that, is I have that same thing. If I talk about Jesus, I never have issues. It's when I talk about all the things that go with Christendom that I have issues, right? It's like everyone kind of thinks Jesus was a cool guy because he was.
That's right.
So, you know what I mean? Like, I just think it's fascinating. I love, Maya, you said this too. And then Matt, you said this again in another way, but I think this is one of the major shifts is you said, we want these things to come from. So like one of our work is to actually learn, listen to leaders that exist in these communities, regardless of who they are, and then let the work come through them. So again, Matt, you said this when you introduced yourself, like my job is to find and be inspired and be led by these incredible leaders and then figure out how I resource those leaders to actually do the work that they need to do. And Maya, you said the same thing about your development strategy. Like we're looking for who the leaders are in this community and then looking for how this work, how we can help this work come through them. So it's not like, dun, 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 we're the like saviors of the day. We're the answers to your prayer. Like we're the ones you've been waiting for, but actually all of the answers to their prayers are there. And you're helping them to discover them and to resource these existing leaders on the ground. That sounds to me like a massive development shift. So anyway, it's beautiful. You guys are inspiring. I could talk to you all day. I love the work that you're doing. Maya, as a fellow peace builder, peacemaker, or trying my best, I am learning from you. I'm thrilled that you're in this game. That vision I'll never forget of you as a little girl in this program where you're starting the seed of like we could do things differently and know each other differently and live differently, being fully realized now more and more in your life. I mean, what a beautiful story. I love it so much. I hope it keeps inspiring you to keep working in very difficult contexts, cheering you on. And Matt, thanks for leveraging your privilege so well. Keep doing it. And let's make a difference, huh? Let's do what we can to bring the shalom, the calling, the thriving, the abundant life. So proud to know you guys. Thanks for what you're doing. We're cheering you on. Any last minute, just like, I forgot to say this and I should have said this, or like.
I might say just that I can't thank you enough, Danielle, for emphasizing the inescapable call of peace on the life of the Christian. For some reason, in many Western faith traditions, we lost that thread and we forgot or like pushed down that's Matthew 5:9, blessed are the peacemakers. We just like, I don't know, forgot it or put it away or, you know, put it in the back chapter and put other things first. It is a mandate on every believer to be a force for peace. Mm-hmm. And to wage peace in our actions, in our words, mm-hmm. and thank you for speaking up for that. Thank you for advocating for that. Thank you for preaching on that. Mm-hmm. That's what we need. The church needs to be lit alive on fire with this call of Jesus to be peace builders and peacemakers. Mm-hmm. Thank you for helping light that fire.
So these amazing experts have taught me so much, and I'm so grateful for them. We are condensing what they've taught us into these nuggets that are going to help us identify shifts that are happening with them in the global context, but also in our own heart and mind and context. Daniela is going to share about protecting your heart in the face of immense suffering, which is something all of us need to figure out and how to learn if we're going to enter into the suffering of the world. And then also she shares some thoughts about being a woman leader. And they're really important to pay attention to. McLean helps us think theologically and pragmatically through what a church's work is. So for me, I was really challenged by his thoughts around churches moving from an internal conversation of behavior and discipleship and into a what discipleship is for conversation, which is being salt and light in the communities around them. And his words and experience have been incredibly challenging to me, and I hope they're equally challenging to you as you listen to these experts from their own mouths.
I'm Daniela Busducha. So my name is very close to yours. I'm Daniela Busducha, and I'm the leader for advocacy and external engagement for World Vision Global Partnership. And I'm in this position for 3 years now. Prior to this, I was the national director of World Vision Romania. And I'm a social worker. I'm a mom of two already adults, adult children, and I'm a Christian.
Beautiful. That's nice. That's a good introduction. You want to talk me through, so advocacy and external engagement. So one of the things we're trying to focus on in this podcast specifically are shifts, just significant shifts. And in my conversations with folks from World Vision, we've just talking about shifts in development, you know, how we've done it before, how we do it now, why we shifted. I'd imagine going from directing a country effort for World Vision to advocacy and external engagement is a big shift. Want to walk me through why you made that shift, why World Vision thinks that's an important shift in its development work?
For me personally, it was such a natural shift because mm-hmm. I'm a social worker, and for social workers, trying to help build systems always involves dialogue with the decision makers that can make changes that are lasting, that are systemic, that are creating the premises for the children to have access to those services that are just so critical mm-hmm. for their development on who God created them to be from the beginning. So for me personally, shifting from social work to advocacy was absolutely natural. For World Vision, advocacy has always been there. It's one of the three pillars of our work. We are a humanitarian development and advocacy organization. This is what defines us. And I like to say that for more than 7 years now, when you say World Vision, you actually say working in those communities that are hardest to reach with vulnerable children and doing something to change the injustice that is keeping them in that circle of vulnerability.
When you have an advocacy arm, you know, it's bringing light to places that have been in the dark. So they've been thriving and sort of like not talked about because it's complex or difficult. So you're bringing this to the light. And then this public, so this is, I was going to ask you about the difference between policy making as advocacy and public movement as advocacy and how those two things, sometimes I feel like, well, there's a whole bunch of things. I feel like nonprofits who do good work and help people tend to emphasize their compassionate mercy at the expense oftentimes of the justice and advocacy that is required to end the situation. So that's like its own conflict and can be, right? This like dance that you have to do between mercy and compassion and actually justice and advocacy. How do you, I guess that's your job to navigate that within World Vision, where you press back and say, actually, it's nice that you're being compassionate to these people, but this isn't going to solve the problem. We actually have to get to those root causes. Is there pushback, or is it just more what's the most strategic thing to do in this situation?
No, I don't think I've seen necessarily a pushback, because the needs of the people we serve around the world are both immediate needs, mm-hmm. where you need compassion. Mm-hmm. They are development needs where you need longer term programming. And mm-hmm. this is where the fact that we have sponsorship and allows us to be in the community for a longer term, working with them and being able to plan people's way out of poverty is becoming so critically important. And I'm sorry, this was a parenthesis. But at the same time, we are all aware that we are not trying to replace or take the duties of the governments being silenced when injustice is happening to children. Mm-hmm. Where you see, for example, that certain categories of children are excluded from mm-hmm. services that are critical for their development, you have to speak up. Mm-hmm. So I would see them more on a continuum than being an either or. I think it's important that advocacy is embedded in the planning from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Just looking at what are the mechanisms here that mm-hmm. continue to perpetuate poverty, continue to perpetuate circles of vulnerability, including child marriage. If you think about child marriage, it is such a huge form of injustice for the girls. It's right there at the crossroad of intergenerational vulnerability. It's right there because a child's bride, it's not only being exposed to huge risks herself, risks of abuse, risks of multiple early pregnancies that can absolutely kill her. If you look at the risk of maternal death for girl brides, it's six times higher than for a mature, more mature mother. So that's a form of injustice in itself. So we cannot be silenced about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. What would you say to people who are in their own work and they're just like, I don't know what I'm going to, I have a couple of questions for you, but like, they're like, I don't know, this advocacy seems like people are just angry all the time and no one's ever happy and I can never get it right. Like, what would you say to people who maybe just don't know what to do? How would they begin? What are the things that you've learned that have helped you along this journey to keep you directed for being an advocate? I feel like it's so, you know, around the world, it feels like God has just raised up strong female, young female voices to really awaken the world around issues, you know, like, so back in the day it was Malala, right? I mean, she's still hard at it. And then we have the climate change activist, who's brought the whole world, you know, right. And then you have, you know, Sarah Mana in Ghana, and you've got, Mata in Angola, you know, speaking to the UN. And it seems like, you know, it's so exciting from a Christian standpoint, because of course, when Jesus was coming and everything was going to shift, and he told a woman, a teenage girl, that she'd be the one that would usher it in, right? So it feels very kind of like prophetic in some ways. I was watching a woman interview Boris Johnson from the UK in the press room around this invasion of the Ukraine. And as a reporter, she just, you know, she started asking kind of normal questions about like why England wasn't doing much and why they couldn't do more. And then as he kind of responded with these like politically glib phrases, she got more and more agitated and actually began crying, like in her saying, like, you know, while you're saying there's nothing you can do, Ukrainian mothers are, you know, losing their children. And she just like went into this, launched into this. It was clear by the end that she was Ukrainian or connected to somebody deeply that was Ukrainian. So she could not separate this issue from her own heart in her own life. I guess what I want to ask you about in this space where you're seeing and hearing these incredibly difficult, unjust, wrong, horrible things all the time, how do you, or do you, you know, how do you protect your heart? How do you engage in advocacy that is actually, you know, not like you just like pouring your heart out on the floor every single time? Or is that the best strategy? Like, how do you, what are your strategies for surviving, I guess, this role and maybe thriving in it?
It's very hard not to pour your heart when you're talking about injustice and children in the same sentence. And at the same time, you know that the arguments are strong enough. They are not emotional arguments. So what Vision is using very much evidence base to look at what is possible and what is unjust. We are trying to prove our case when we talk about justice. We talk about, for example, the lack of funding to protect children in humanitarian space. We look at figures and we look at what is the percentage of allocation for child protection specifically from the entire budget that is being allocated. And we do point to facts. We use figures. But we also use stories. We also, because we know those children, we know who they are.
Right.
And we are able to base everything that we are saying on our experience on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we have such a significant global presence at the community level, mm-hmm. we are, in fact, the organization with the widest geographic spread. This is what gives us credibility. And again, it doesn't have to be us.
Yeah.
We can bring and we've seen the difference that it makes when you're bringing the unfiltered voice of the mm-hmm. children
right.
who are in the context, of the people who are in the context and who can talk about how their life changed mm-hmm. as a result of a certain type of intervention mm-hmm. that can easily be adopted, scaled, and mm-hmm. it would change lives of so many more.
So it's a combo of data and story in the end, and data Absolutely. Driving people to realize this is in your best interest. Because I think that's a lot of advocacy is saying like, guys, think this through, like this is going to help you in the end. You're going to save this much money if you just empower a kid now, right? Like this is going to actually be of great use later. And then also the stories. I love that actually too, how World Vision gets itself out of the center. I mean, that's also one of the great hard things to do as a big nonprofit is to get yourself out of the center of the story. And I feel like people are motivated by inspiration way more than anything else. And the places you find transformation, this was true. I remember in Gender Violence, when I read Half the Sky, you know, by Nicholas Kristof or whatever, and his wife, and they were almost apologizing. Like, we're really sorry, but the places we saw the most transformation were faith-based organizations doing work on the ground with women. Like, they basically were like, we're sorry. We know this isn't like cool, but like, it's true. Like, this is the truth when we're investigating it. And I always thought it was so funny, one, they were apologizing for it, but two, that that's where the transformation is. So you can have wonderful, you know, stats and you can have beautiful policy, but the real transformation seems to be rooted in this kind of faith-based approach that God needs to be at work here or nothing will change. My last question to you is, you've been doing a lot of work in male-dominated spaces. How is that as a woman leader? Do you have anything to say about that or things that you would recommend to other people who might be listening who are women and just sort of discouraged in those spaces?
When I started my profession, I was in the first generation of social workers in Eastern Europe, even. Mm-hmm. So everywhere you looked, the need was huge. After 40 years of Romanian communist regime banning mm-hmm. any social assistance of people in need, the need was huge. But especially in the child protection system, where we had more than 100,000 children housed, some of them in horrible situations that were jeopardizing their life and their well-being. But even in that context, sometimes our professional opinion was sought, but not always, and certainly not in strategic conversations, not in decision-making conversations. And I remember exactly when it happened, Daniel. I know exactly when it happened. It was my USAID leader at the time, Lucia Correll, an amazing woman leader who realized what was happening in those conversations and who intentionally started to create space for me to speak because she knew that I was able to bring valuable ideas to the table and I was never given the space to do it. Mm. And she started to do that systematically. Mm. So when Lucia left Romania, she moved to another post and I got into her position. I was already an established leader in my professional community. And that changed the game for me because I was able to contribute to systems thinking and more strategic conversations, and that creates a totally different space. Mm-hmm. So this is why I think it's critical for the leaders to realize and to actively observe those situations when unintendedly, maybe, young women leaders are being silenced or not being provided enough space to share their ideas, to add their value, to really be able to grow in that mm-hmm. space. And I'm just so proud to be working in an organization that is valuing young leaders' voices, especially young women, girls, and women leaders' voices, because they do bring a lot of value from an experience. It's their lived experience. It's what they are seeing on the ground. If we are humble enough and wise enough to listen to them and to take their words to heart, I think we could be just so much more agile because we don't have to guess. We have the answers right there. We just have to listen.
Yeah, wow. That's beautiful. I think one of my favorite terms that World Vision people keep using is bold humility, you know, which I think is what you're describing, is that boldness of like, we've got to get the truth. We have to speak the truth. We have to be there. And then this humility where like, we also have to listen, and the way we present this matters, you know, like our posture of like humility will be such a strategic way of advancing truth, right? So great. So somebody saw you, identified you, made room for you, made it possible for you to have a seat at the table. And now you're setting your own table and you're making lots of room there too, I would imagine. And on this goes. So for those of you listening, of course, if you're listening to this podcast, you know, this is always already a big deal to me. And I think it might hold the key to changing everything is to include and empower women and girls. And this might be the secret. Even secular journalists have discovered this to be the secret of development. So we want to just really shout out to all organizations and nonprofits everywhere that change is possible. And that if you could be humble enough to listen and be strategic enough to identify young females. Now, if you're, I've talked about this before. Like if you're in a board meeting and everybody around that board meeting is the same exact person as you, who comes from the same background, comes from the same culture, comes from the same, you know, then something's wrong with your leadership. Quite literally, I would say that's a terrible way to lead. The monocultural leadership strategy, which will not impact anyone except people who look like you. So, and I can't tell you, it seems such a no-brainer, but I can't tell you how many times I've been around those tables and people are like, we just can't figure out how to, and I'm like, right, you can't figure it out and you will never figure it out because you don't have the right people around this table. So even that I think is so powerful just to say like, can you identify other people that are different from you, from different cultures, from different backgrounds, and particularly in many male dominated space, asking even that question, why aren't there women around this table? Where are the women that should be around this table? And go ask them, intentionally make a way for them to join that conversation and see what it might shift and open and bring. I think a lot of things could change just by that posture. So thanks for saying that so well. I think that's a beautiful, I think even to say it like, my voice wasn't being heard, even though I was welcome into this place, my voice still wasn't reaching where it needed to reach until someone could see that and make space for that and make a way for that to change. And I think sometimes, you know, many times we also think that things will just change. If women are in the room, things will just change. And then they're like, why aren't they changing? And women get really irritated at this because they have the skills and the lived experience and the education and the data. I mean, they're not lacking in anything, but their voice isn't being heard still. They're just in the room.
I think you've seen it as well, Danielle, and I've seen it. Organizational cultures change when women are participating in decision-making processes.
Yes.
Planning is better, but also the team cohesion is different. And that is becoming such an important, such a powerful element in our society.
McLean, what a privilege to speak to you and to make time for this. Thanks for making the time. Do you want to, just for listeners of the podcast, do you want to just introduce yourself a little bit? Tell me a little bit about what you're doing and why you're doing it, maybe how you got there.
Oh, yeah. Well, my name is McLean Davidson-Tshojo. I am Zimbabwean. My descent is South African. I am based in Johannesburg. I've been working with World Vision since 2001 with the national office. Then I moved to the Africa region 2009. Then I worked with the Global Center. Then I took off in 2017. then came back mid-March last year. So it's really a great privilege for me to be a part of this organization, this ministry. And really what brought me into World Vision was that I had always been captivated by the idea of doing ministry beyond discipleship and evangelism. And I was observing to realize that much of the work that we were doing as church was around church planting, which is great, discipleship, but not much in the area of social concern. So, and it was at a time when I was just transitioning from one profession to the other. I had a sense of the call of the Lord and I went to study theology. And just as I completed my studies, God opened this door. And I knew that this was where God was calling me.
You're in South Africa. You're with World Vision. Talk to me about some of the shifts that you're seeing happen, even in your work and development. I love also that idea that you just shared about how your own personal shift was moving out of a church context for discipleship and moving really discipleship and impact for the kingdom outside of the church and into social concern and areas in the world that need some help and attention. Maybe talk to me about those things. So that's a lot altogether. So whatever one you want to start with, but this area, the shift in your own personal calling that might actually be part of World Vision's calling to help the church shift from a conversation with itself to a conversation that actually is going to impact social systems all around the world.
Yeah, well, you know, the biggest shift, let me speak maybe in the context of church and society. One of the major shifts that we are seeing, especially in our part of the world, is previously the church was very divorced from issues of social concern. Whether it is about the welfare of the people or whether it was about issues of governance. Now, we are seeing the church awaken to the calling of going into public spaces, whether it is in engaging on issues that are political or issues of health, you know, issues of justice, which are big issues. We are a very relational culture. And because we are relational, sometimes the confrontational aspect gets to go missing, because sometimes confrontation would be viewed as something that is negative without people recognizing that, you know, we will need to confront in life. So there is this huge shift where not only church leaders in terms of the ordained ministers in the church, but laity, you know, are Christians in the everyday workplace, where we are seeing more Christians getting active in the business spaces and speaking up on issues of ethics in business, for instance. You know, we have churches getting involved in the health sector. Previously, it was the churches like the Catholic Church, for instance. In our part of the world, the Catholic Church has pretty much been speaking into much of those spaces. But there is an awakening within the Protestant, you know, churches where mainline Protestants, you know, evangelicals, you know, Pentecostals, you know, are getting to get out to express ministry within public spaces. So that for us is a major shift, but it came with a lot of pain. I'll tell you a story. When I was in Zimbabwe, and the country was going through a time of pain, you know, where there was politically motivated violence. The state was investing in violence and disruptive behavior. And here we are as World Vision. We are bringing together. In fact, they were investing so much in dividing the church, because that country is much of Southern Africa and East Africa. We are like 60, 70, 80% Christian. So they were very aware of the power within the church, that if the church begins to act collectively, then there is a possibility that undesirable shifts may begin happening. So we were investing in peace building and unity within the churches to an extent that the key ecclesiastical institutions, which were speaking in dissonated voices, you know, began to speak together. Yes, you're talking about the Catholic, the Evangelicals, and the Council of Churches group, where they began to speak together in unison for the sake of peace and especially justice for children. So we are observing these kind of shifts that are happening and happening at different levels. Community level, you know, national level, regional level, you know. For instance, during the time of COVID, the regional actors, in terms of those within the church that are heading the key church movements or the key traditions of the three that I've just mentioned, we have found that they've been very active in terms of, for instance, access to the vaccine, you know, speaking against this inequality in terms of distribution and access. So church leaders have been speaking on different platforms and their voices being heard. And that's the beauty of it, that there is a time where political leaders would say, well, you know, yours is, you belong to the sacred, and, you know, you have nothing to do with issues that are secular. These are kind of thing. So we're seeing the bridging of the secular and the sacred, where the values of the faith are beginning to seep into these practices and norms within secular society that normally put children and their families and communities at risk. Mm. Yeah.
I went to Zimbabwe and lived there for a couple of weeks in a small little village with a friend of mine who's a very, very gifted African leader who I just went to learn from. You know, I just was like, how are you doing all this stuff? You're incredible. Mm. So it was 9 years ago. Mm. And so it was pretty tense. You know, we went in a time where it was tense. We were followed around, you know, where we were questioned for a little while. And then even while we were there, the church that my friend led was asked to be a political hub. You know, they asked if they would host the political leaders coming in with the establishment, you know, like, and so as you were talking about, and I think this is a fear in America too. So like in America, this is true as well, like where the church becomes this conduit for the power of the state to kind of almost monopolize the church. So I guess maybe this is the fear, the good desire of separating church and state, of course, is to not allow the church to become this like place of power that can be utilized by the, you know, powerful oppressive practices or even just worldly principles of power. But then the total separation where the church is no longer being salt and light, you know, there's no longer a church being a witness in that space. And that's also terrible. So how do you protect the church from being co-opted by power? And how do you make sure that the church is actually contributing in a way in unity and peace building that actually is bringing salt and light to the world?
Well, you know, it's the rediscovery of the theological premise of relevance. What does it mean to be church? What does it mean to be salt and light? And we know that salt is going to work itself into the elements. But, you know, if the salt gets co-opted, then the salt loses its saltiness.
Right.
So it's on one hand, at least according to what we have learned in our engagement with churches, on one hand, the clarity of our missionary mandate to speak prophetically, you know, forth-telling into power, you know, but knowing that though we are the salt, we are not part of the institute of governance. So it's this whole, if you're looking at how Jesus and the apostles worked, they were not in the system, but they turned their world upside down. You know, so it's on one hand clarifying our biblical mandate to speak prophetically in our times, but being wary that there is potential of being sucked in or being squeezed into the mold of the world, which Paul talks about, you know. So being wary that, you know, we are walking, in fact, this is very unfamiliar ground, because for decades, our those that went before us, at least for us, they were not quite active in the way that they should. So it's as if we are getting into a place of pioneering, though in South Africa, the churches were quite active when it led to the shift from apartheid to democracy.
Yeah. You know? Like a big, big part. A big, big part.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But it seemed as though, you know, when this huge, seemingly accomplishment has been settled, the church kind of goes back to its lab.
Right.
I think we have seen it with HIV, you know, when issues of HIV and prevalence were so high, when we hit the place where, you know, the that started going down. The behaviors were changing, and the changes were catalyzed. Some started to kind of sit back and say, well, you know, we've got this done and dusted. And before we knew it, you know, there were new reinfections coming through.
One of the things that can protect and maybe inspire the church to be involved prophetically and to be salt and light in the world and to really affect systems for good is holding the center. You know, obviously discipleship, Jesus holds the center, but also putting the most vulnerable. Like, so this, I think this is maybe where World Vision really helps, where we say, actually, at the center of our nonprofit, at the center of all of our work is the most vulnerable child. That's who's at the center of this work. So when the church speaks and when the church uses its power, when the church uses, you know, think 70, 80% of the population are in church. So you do, I mean, you'd have to be really dumb not to recognize the power that is held collectively in the church, right? Yeah, so of course, everyone who wants power is going to be attracted to that place because that's where that is. But I wonder if the church is willing to leverage its power for the most vulnerable, that's where we're the most like Jesus in the world.
Well, you know, interestingly, I was talking to a few friends a few days ago, and I was saying, well, you know, the nature of our work is such that I gave the example of Ezekiel. You know, here Ezekiel is of the priestly descent, and he's at the time that he should ordinarily start serving, you know, as a priest, and but there was no place to serve. You know, the church was gone, the people were in captivity, and what does God do? God takes him and places him amongst people in captivity. So I said, you know, there has to be a way that we are willing to be immersed as believers and as the church in the context of vulnerability. And when we are immersed there, we cannot help it but begin to respond to issues that come into the intersectionality of faith and society. There is no way that when we are in there, we will not be mindful of the fact that children are at risk. You know, we will be aware of certain factors of vulnerability, that in this context, there is extreme deprivation, you know. They are exploitative practices. So in that intersectionality, within the context of vulnerability, we cannot help it but inquire, you know, begin to ask ourselves and question each other in terms of how relevant are we or how relevant are we going to. But the greatest inquiry would be then going to the Lord, because even in developmental work or whatever work we do in the marketplace, it's the recognition that God is already present. So how would God desire our ministry to express itself within this context of vulnerability? But we don't stop there. But you recognize that we have to live in interdependence. You know, and this is what COVID taught us, that we need each other.
Hey, thanks so much, everybody, for listening to this podcast, Power Shift. We are very honored that you're part of this. If you have a chance, would you please go to daniellestrickland.com/podcast if you want to look at all the other episodes, all the other seasons. And if you want to go to wherever you listen to your podcast and leave a review, that would be awesome as well. I love this form of communication. It's longer form, and it's an option to be able to get some information out in a timely way and in a way that might matter. This whole season has been just such a delight to do. Another shout out to World Vision and a thanks for their ongoing partnership and all that they do around the world. And you can check them out too, and be part of that world change. This next season that we're going to launch really soon is a mini season. We're hoping it's going to be the best flipping podcast season ever. And it is going to feature all kinds of things about Jesus and overthrowing temple tables, flipping the script, and it is going to be a taste and a reflections around The Other Side, which is a brand new book I am releasing the first week of August, The Other Side. So if you're interested in that, that's coming up soon. I am so excited about this book, and I'm excited about this mini podcast season, and I'm excited about the stories and the information that we offer there. So if you want to get in on that, and you want to get in on that a bit early with some free chapter downloads and some bonus content, you can go to daniellestrickland.com/other side of hope, other side of hope. And you can sign up to get a bonus, to get all the bonus stuff. So God bless you guys. And may we keep reimagining power and enter into what God is doing, a right side upping of our world, and do it together. Thanks for listening. God bless you.